not to be, to be or not to be.
Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows and reaper drones of those who make outrageous fortunes from the suicide bomb of fossil fuel. A sacrifice zone for the 1% in their green zones.
To be or not to be, to be or not to be. To be or not to be,
to be engaged in this existential struggle.
To be or not to be,
between life on earth and an economic model, or to take arms against a rising sea of troubles, and by opposing them from the ground up.
To bring you a public service announcement by the Axis of Dissent.
And good morning once again. Here we are, Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm Paul Rowland. We've got three guests here in the studio. Oh, but of course, that was Danbert No Bacon, you should know, because he was on my show a few weeks ago. And the Axis of Dissent with one of the cuts from his new release, whose name I forgot, but that was To Be or Not to Be. So, we are here in the studio with Lindsay Grazel.
Yeah.
Grazel, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And Dea Schlossberg.
Yep.
And Ken Ward.
Hey, Paul.
And we are going to be talking about a film, parts of which are going to be shown tomorrow evening at the Hollywood Theater, which is going to be a fundraiser for the completion of said film.
Yes.
Got that right?
That's right.
The Reluctant Radical, Filming the Fossil Fuel Resistance. And Lindsay, you are the director and co-producer, and Dea, you are the co-producer, and Ken, you are the subject of the film. So we've got all the bases covered here this morning. And of course, we're sandwiched in between the March on Science on last Saturday and the Climate March this coming Saturday, both of which have editions here in Portland, Oregon. Oh yeah, speaking of which, I was going to rattle off a few community events. So here we go, before we get started. People's Climate Movement Portland Mobilization March. This Saturday from 12 noon to 5 p.m., starting at Dawson Park at North Stanton Street and Williams Avenue at noon, and heading to, I believe, Buckman Park in Southeast Portland. So, Opal, Oregon, that's a environmental justice group, and their partners in the Oregon Just Transition Alliance are calling on Oregon's environmental justice communities and anyone who stands with people of color and low-income people to join the movements for racial, social, and economic justice as pathways to climate action. That's number one. They have a Facebook page, of course. So that's People's Climate Movement Portland Mobilization in March. This Saturday, Defend Portland from Fascists at the Avenue of Roses Parade. Saturday, 9 a.m. At Eastport Plaza. That's 4000 Southeast 82nd Avenue. Fascists plan to march through the streets of Portland in the Avenue of Roses Parade on 82nd, they say. Liam says he thinks it's been canceled. Well, I just saw it on Facebook now. It didn't say anything about being canceled, but people can check it out and find out for yourselves. Let's see. Rally for Renewables at PGE's annual shareholder meeting. That's this morning, 9 a.m. to 10:30 at 25 Southwest Salmon Street, hosted by Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility and some other groups. PGE can help Portland meet our climate commitment, or they can lock us into 30 years of toxic pollution with their proposed Carty fracked gas power plants in eastern Oregon. Tell PGE shareholders we need wind and solar today. That's today, April 26th, at the World Trade Center downtown, 9 to 10:30 a.m., so right after I am off the air. You can rush over there or rush over right now. Probably even better, do something. So there you have it. And Ken Ward, I didn't fully introduce you. You used to be involved with the PERG movement.
I was for nearly 20 years.
Nearly 20 years, and you were deputy executive director of Greenpeace and co-founder of a number of organizations, including Green Core, National Environmental Law Center, and there's another fairly long list. People can go to Wikipedia and find all that out. And actually, I'm kind of curious. I notice in your writings, you've written a number of responses to A Death of Environmentalism. We can talk about that as we go along.
Okay.
Let's talk about the film. So I first met you, Daya. You were going around with the Josh Fox's, now it's not his latest film, because he has another new film out, right, which maybe you know something about. But that film was touring around, and I saw it in Portland, and I interviewed him, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change. You all did a little workshop with Tim DeChristopher. How could I forget? I've also interviewed him a couple times. You were involved in making that film and others. And Lindsay, I was in touch with you by email, I believe, because you were arrested. Were you arrested on the action that Ken did?
Yeah.
Yes. We were. And we'll talk. So talk about that. How'd you get involved in filming Ken when he turned off the valve of the, it was the tar sands pipeline, right?
Yes.
How'd you get involved in that?
Well, I actually started filming Ken in July of 2015, back when Shell Oil's Fenica ship was coming into town. So that's when the documentary started, and I had been following him for a while leading up to that day on October 11th when he turned off the valve at the tar sands, the Trans Mountain Pipeline, rather.
And where was that?
That's just outside Anacortes, Washington, in Burlington.
And you got off, right, on your charges? Is that?
Yes, my charges have been dropped at this point.
Excellent, because you were all the people. There were six people involved in the action, and then other people filming. Is that right?
There were there were five people who actually turned off the valves, and there were four people who were in support. Well, I'm sorry, three people in support, and four independent video documentarians,
and
including
Dea
and Lindsay, and three of the. The documentarians were arrested, held, and charged, and all the support people are, and all five valve turners, of course.
And everybody was facing initially felony charges, and so a number of people got off so far. And how about the other cases?
All of the support people and all of the valve turners are still facing felony charges, and one of the, Steve Lipte, is still facing charges in Minnesota as well.
And When do the next court dates come?
Well, I'm first. I've already went to trial at the end of January on two felony charges in Mount Vernon, and was received a hung jury. I was able to argue little bits of what's called a necessity defense, essentially the world's ending as we know it, and we ought to do something about it, and there's no legal alternatives available to us, and at least one member of the jury agreed. And now I'm facing retrial at the end of May, May 22nd, and I'm back in court next week on the 3rd to argue again whether we can offer a necessity defense.
Yeah, they don't give up on those kind of cases too easily, do they?
Not so far. I keep thinking, well, maybe let's wake up one morning and go, no, this is the kind of thing we ought to be supporting, not prosecuting, but not yet.
Well, we can talk about that, because that whole necessity defense and that strategy of going through the, you know, taking it directly into the court system and arguing something I was involved with somewhat back in the heyday of the forest protection movement. Some of us used the necessity defense, not to great success, but we actually got off. But that's another story. We got off because we're sitting in the road, and they accused us of sitting in a public road, but we pointed out that it was actually, how could you say it was a, we were interfering with traffic, because they had already closed off the road to like arrest us, so like nobody could get in. So the jury agreed with us on that minor technical point.
I love those little technical points. So far, we haven't found one, but you know.
Anyway, so you've been involved in filming Ken, and more generally, obviously, filming the fossil fuel resistance in general is kind of the theme. Ken has sort of put himself in the eye of the storm, so he's obviously a good subject to follow. But I noticed you had various footage from various actions in this film. So how did you? And I'll ask you the same question, Dea. But how did you get involved in doing this kind of filmmaking? Have you always been active and, you know, involved in this kind of these kind of issues? Or
no, I've always been worried about climate change, but not to the extent that obviously the Ken is. And when I met Ken and had a conversation with him for about an hour about climate change, I left that conversation realizing that things were far worse than I thought they were. And that there were actually things that we could do and that I should step up my game. I also thought he was just a really compelling character. And because I'm a documentary filmmaker, that intrigued me greatly. And I thought, what a great way to tell the stories. If he can convince me of that in an hour, if I could make a film that a lot of people could see, that could do some good. So.
And so how did you all get connected, Dea?
Well, I was actually filming the same action in North Dakota at the time. One of the oil sands pipelines that comes from the U.S. into Canada goes through goes through the corner of North Dakota. That's the Keystone Pipeline. And I was there filming the activist there who was turning off that pipeline. And I was also arrested at the same time, charged with 3 felonies, held in jail. And Lindsay and I, after we were released from jail and things settled a little bit.
So you got your charges dropped as well?
They're not dropped. They're currently suspended.
Which means they can come back and pick them up at any time.
Well, I have a date, a date set where they are supposed to be dropped by, as long as nothing happens between now and then. So I'm anxiously awaiting that date. They're essentially just on the back burner. So after the arrest, after the dust settled a little bit, Lindsay and I got on the phone to talk legal. I mean, we both have never been in this kind of situation before, arrested and charged for doing our jobs, essentially. So we were trying to figure out how to best approach this, and commiserating, and realized that we shared a lot of the same values and goals, and Lindsay shared with me some scenes from the film, and I was immediately taken by the approach and how beautifully I think she has captured Ken's story and his struggle that I think speaks to so many of us who have been in the climate movement and the environmental movement for a long time. Just basically asked, like, can I get involved? Because this looks amazing. And so we decided that I would come on as co-producer and help finish up the film. And
so did you move out to Oregon then?
I didn't. No, I'm based in New York.
Well, that's right. Now things, you know, with the internet, it changes things. Right. I forgot. I keep forgetting about that. I was born and grew up long before that. You
know. And it's been wonderful to have her on board. She's got tons of experience in areas that I don't have. And so it's been a really good fit for us to collaborate.
Right on. And this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm Paul Roland, the host every week here on KBOO from 8 to 9. We have a talk radio every weekday morning with different hosts each day. I'm Wednesday, and I'm speaking with two filmmakers who are going to be presenting some portions of this new film that's going to be coming out, The Reluctant Radical, about Ken Ward and other things, and who's also here in the studio. And we're going to talk directly to him since people have been talking about his story. He can speak himself. But the number to call in, since this is a call-in program, is 503-231-8187. And again, that's tomorrow, April 27th at the Hollywood Theater at 7:30, which is part of the Eco Film Festival. And that's up, of course, at Northeast 41st and Sandy. Anyone who doesn't know that, the great old Hollywood Theater, classic place. And this is a fundraiser to help finish this film, since obviously now with the internet, it also changes fundraising too. There's Kickstarter and everything. And you also have a Kickstarter campaign, which is also on the program page here at kbo.fm/Wednesday Talk Radio. So there's going to be some other things there too. I want to, your film Backyard. I want to talk a little bit about that. That's your film. I'm sorry. It says Schlossberg right here.
Backyard is a film about, it's a short half hour film about fracking and human impacts of fracking. And it's five people's stories from pretty different parts of life and different worlds, but they're all encountering the same issues in regards to fracking. And I made that several years back, and that's actually what put me in touch with Josh originally and how we linked up the whole fracking world. So we're screening that tomorrow night along with several of the scenes from The Reluctant Radical.
And of course, all three of you will be there, I assume?
Yes.
Yeah? And so there'll be a panel. And all right, well, people can get a full dose if you haven't already here in Portland, one of the kind of the centers of resistance to climate change, such as it is. I wish, you know, I was reading this thing about the climate march and, you know, prioritizing people of color and environmental justice. If only, you know, the broader environmental movement had taken that to heart 25 years ago, might have been in a different place right now. You think, Ken?
Well, I could talk about this for several hours straight. So, I think we've been on a completely wrong-headed trajectory. And to the extent we have any strategy, it's been elitist. And it's been based on some fundamental wrong-headed assumptions, you know, one of which is that we could somehow solve climate without ever actually having a political fight about it. Another is that we could solve climate by elitist insider lobbying in D.C. And another that you've already mentioned is that we could solve climate without it being, in any way linking to any of the other fundamental political fault lines in the country. All of those things are wrongheaded. All of those things we've clearly lost. And it would be nice if we rethought them, even at this late date.
Always. Better late than ever, or even better too late than ever, as I sometimes say, to the annoyance of people I know. We had somebody on early on. Do we still have Camilo on the line?
Yes, I am here.
Okay, go ahead. You've been patiently waiting.
I want to announce a gathering an hour before the start of the event on Saturday of Buddhists and all people who believe in do no harm. I can't tell you exactly where it's going to be because I won't know until 10 o'clock that morning. But at Dawson Park at 11 o'clock somewhere, look for the Buddhist Peace Fellowship banner, which I'll be carrying hopefully aloft. And at 11 o'clock, Buddhists and all other like-minded people will gather for a meditation. And I'm expecting that it will be a standing meditation to indicate that Buddhists stand as well as sit for what they believe in.
Nice. Fair enough. Nice. All right. Well, great. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
I will attempt to add that to my program page. Dave, I wanted to ask you this one thing, because a local climate activist mentioned something to me which kind of took me aback. I was telling him, you know, that I was really taken by that how to let go of the world and love all things climate can't change. It really, I don't know, just, you know, it's hard to get anything at all together in this world in general with everything arrayed as it is. And, you know, putting together a film, as you two know, is not, you know, the easiest thing. It takes a lot of focus and takes money. It takes energy. But I, and then in that film, I just thought, you know, because all of us, like, as people will see in the clip of, you know, what Ken was struggling with, some, you know, depression issues and just difficulty of relating to people, which I'd like to talk to you some about. And I thought Josh really captured the how, you know, one person, and him being a filmmaker, obviously he's got a great opportunity to really deal with it, sort of how he went deep into, like, the heart of, like, all this overwhelming stuff and sort of came out of it in this really interesting way. And I just thought it was a sort of a natural progression. I haven't seen Gasland 2. I did see Gasland mm-hmm. 1 when it first came out years and years ago. And it seems sort of this evolution. It's like, you know, I assume if you're a filmmaker of a certain type, you know, you kind of want to move with, you know, your own perceptions of the world. You don't want to just maybe keep doing the same thing over again. Anyway, this climate activist was like, you know, he heard that a lot of the fracking activists were mad at Josh because he had, you know, like, abandoned the struggle or something. Did you ever hear any sort of pushback, you know, regarding people's reactions?
I didn't. A lot of the support we got from people for How to Let Go came straight out of the fracking community.
That's what I would have thought.
I think people are generally... people who get involved in one struggle, I think, start to realize how connected they are to other struggles. I think once you, have some skin in the game, your eyes are more open to other people who also are in similar positions and fighting for related issues. So I didn't really encounter much of that. The fracking fight is the climate fight. Like, it's one, you know, it's just one component of the larger picture.
Yeah, I was kind of, it didn't make any sense to me because I thought it was, anyway, if people haven't seen that, I would really recommend, we should bring that back to a theater in Portland. I assume people can find that as well?
Yeah, it's on HBO, it's on iTunes and Google Play and all the streaming services. But yeah, HBO Now, HBO Go.
So the number to call in, as I mentioned, 503-231-8187. Please don't wait until the last 10 minutes like people often do. It makes it more difficult and you might not get on. So call in now and talk to Lindsay Graizell, who's a director and co-producer of this new film, The Reluctant Radical, about Ken Ward and the fossil fuel resistance, and Dea Schlossberg, who you just heard just a second ago. And Ken, I had mentioned this, this issue. Obviously, you don't mind being put on the spot since you've been put on the spot innumerable times, both in doing direct action and now in being filmed. And obviously, it's not about you, as I'm sure you're the first person to admit. But since we have to, somebody's got to step up, and the whole game is, you know, amplifying the voice. So, but is it a little bit uncomfortable for you to sort of put your psyche out there?
Yeah, it's totally weird. I mean, really, it's totally weird. It's totally weird somehow having to have personal opinions about stuff. I mean, I was a professional advocate in environmental and public interest groups for nearly 30 years. And during all that time, especially in the Ralph Nader network that I came out of, and even within Greenpeace, I mean, we were there, we were there as professionals. We were not there to tell our personal stories. We were there to talk about the issues and the policy and the politics, and to deliberately remove ourselves. So my entire training is to not do what I'm doing now, it was in fact a deliberate decision on my part, and I'm kind of a private person. I don't really look forward to this. So it was, yes, it's been very strange to be in this, but I think it's important to try for me. I think that partly because people understand, well, we tried for 30 years to talk about policy, didn't work very well. So I'm certainly in a position, and was responsive when Lindsay said, why don't we try this out, that it would be interesting to put myself out there in that way, talk about why, you know, the personal reasons why I am where I am.
Well, you know, the whole issue, you know, obviously there are more people talking about it, obviously, and people in Oregon, people listening to KBOO might get a little more dose of it than other people, like Kathleen Dean Moore out of Corvallis talks a lot about, you know, the psychological impacts. There's, you know, there's support groups, there's websites, there's books, there's articles. It's something that is being discussed. Of course, now with Trump being elected, the phenomenon of a post-Trump depression is widespread. I've felt it in my own way, kind of surprised myself. And it doesn't, obviously, as you know, part of what you were talking about in the first clips that I saw in this, that Lindsay sent me, this new film, were you talking about not only the, you know, the feeling of being overwhelmed and this feeling, the need to do something is sort of that the psychiatrist sort of diagnose you being bipolar with a, you know, manic in an incipient manic episode because of your sense of urgency, which I wonder if other people have similar stories to that, you know, people, you know, talking to their therapists about political stuff. If, you know, I thought, you know, I was hoping that maybe that had sort of, you know, passed a little bit, that maybe therapists were sort of more politically astute, but probably not.
Well, no. At least I can speak to my personal experience, which is that there is a vast. I mean, the second psychiatrist I went to talk to explain my situation, and this is still 10 years ago, said, "What you're well, this person you saw didn't understand climate change? I mean, come on. I think we are in a very different. I mean, we have a whole group of people in the mental health profession who are, in fact, trying to help people with exactly this situation. I was just early in the game, so to speak. I mean, there were really only a handful of people who were saying, not that there weren't people saying there's a problem with climate change, but 10 years ago, there weren't that many people who were saying the world as we know it is threatened. We have to do something fundamentally different here, including in our jobs as environmentalists. I mean, that was a far out there stance. And so, I think people who didn't have any understanding of the problem at that time would and did look at me and go, you're kind of crazy. And there was a part of me that was going, am I crazy? No, wait, I don't think I'm crazy. No, really. I mean, it was a struggle because it was so, you had to accept, you know, data and then compare it to what everybody else was doing and say, no, actually, this is right. And we're on the wrong, fundamentally on the wrong track. We need to be doing something totally different.
Let me just sort of as a bracket, because I've been very sensitized to this, and I know you're not using it in this way, but we just be sensitive to the whole issue of saying, you know, people are crazy and not crazy. It's a very sensitive issue to people who are experiencing mental health issues, and it's a, you know, I think the world is fundamentally, society is fundamentally crazy, and we're all struggling to like remain, you know, somewhat afloat in the middle of this general craziness. So the issue of, like, you know, personal disequilibrium, I guess you would say, is I think we're all struggling with that anyway. So that issue of that's interesting. Were you working with Greenpeace still at that time, 10 years ago?
No, I had left professional work. I actually decided to be an at-home dad. So I was at home for 3 years, and that was the period of time that gave me some time and freedom to think and read and to kind of begin to struggle with some of these questions. I've never felt like I was much different than anybody else. I just thought I had this interesting opportunity. Anybody given 3 years to think and not have to engage day to day might come to the same conclusions. So,
but did you? So I assume, I mean, you would, you know, as so. Well, I guess what I was getting at is, so did you have a like internal conflicts within Greenpeace over, you know, had you? You know, we all kind of, like, I always thought I kind of knew what was going on with climate change, but it wasn't until I got here, got back to Portland and got involved with KABU and was like forced my, you know, interviewed a lot of people and forced myself to read a lot of stuff and came across certain authors who really were kind of, I thought, sort of on the edge. I think Robert Hunsicker, who writes with Counterpunch, like puts himself out there as far as anybody does, like in terms of really understanding what's going on in the Arctic and writing about it. And not just the Arctic, but Fukushima. And he seems to take on like all the worst monsters that we're facing. But anyway, it wasn't really until then that I really felt like I really started to understand deeply what really facing. So while you were working at Greenpeace, had you already started to really understand?
Oh yeah, there's deep internal fights within Greenpeace and other organizations. I mean, we're in a situation here where nothing is really working, where you've got people grasping for a variety of different ideas or solutions from policy to politics of how we should do this. Inside Greenpeace, when I was there, there was in fact a struggle around how important is climate change compared to other issues. You have one measure inside Greenpeace, one measure is how many campaigners do you have working on? And at the time, there were, I think, 20-some-odd campaigners working on other issues and one working on climate change. I thought it should be more 50-50. So, yeah, there was a struggle.
Was that part of why you left Greenpeace or not?
It was one of the reasons why I left, but also the organization was went through a wrenching reorganization that I was part of that involved downsizing the organization. And once you've done something like that or played a leadership role like that, we have to leave.
I'm not sure if that was the one that it seems like Greenpeace had gone through a few of them. I remember when I was really active in the forest protection movement, the local Greenpeace group in Portland was like a big part of like the activist scene, just because there are so many canvassers, people who actually make a miserly living, but could make a living doing canvassing. And they were all committed young people who had extra free time to devote to other things. So that kind of pissed off the national group. They became one of the more independent minded local groups and got into apparently a lot of trouble for it. And so then there's a whole thing that ended to the ending of the canvas operations with, I think, like impacted the overall sort of environmental movement.
That was me. Yeah. One of the people. They closed those offices, yeah.
embarrassing moment. No,
I think it was important. I mean, well, first of all, it was an effort to save the entire organization from collapse.
Right, because there had been some major missteps, financial missteps, right?
It was also a question of what is the function of Greenpeace. And I happen to believe that the function of Greenpeace is to do nimble direct actions of the sort that created the organization that are still crucial to do now, and that Greenpeace has a difficult time doing. And it was at that time, in part, it was difficult to do that because it was a huge, sprawling organization trying to do local community organizing type approaches. And that there's value to that. But if you're going to do that, it becomes much harder to do effective direct action. Huh. I think there is a tension there. And that was part of what played out, as well as the fact that the organization was going bankrupt.
Huh. Well, I'm glad I stuck my foot in my mouth because I've always wondered to get the fuller story. But anyway, we do have a caller.
It wasn't just bad DC people shutting down, effective local folks.
Fair enough. Samantha is on the line, patiently waiting. Go ahead, Samantha.
Hello, how are you guys?
Good.
Hi.
So I consider myself like an eco-feminist, an environmental feminist, and the non-violent communication tactics that I try to use, I think, helps break cognitive dissonance. A lot of people, when we're trying to get messages out, we have these tools of people. We have people who, like you guys said, the whole entire environmental movement, including fracking, it's polarized with this group with this championing this thing and this group championing this thing. But when we really think about climate change and mediating climate change, we've got to get the entire population on board. And when you're communicating to people that what they're doing hurts the environment, a lot of times what people hear is, I'm bad, and that shuts a lot of people down. We are all part of the ecology, and understanding the humans, their niche as part of the biotic community, and then working with people in a way that says, you're not bad, you're just, you know, you're part of a hierarchical structure, excuse me, that promotes some pretty bad things, then maybe we can get some dialogue going and have a broader movement. Again, I think it's all connected. It's interlocked. It's a web. And when we look at our movements and we connect them and we connect together, and we don't like say, hey, so-and-so backed out of something because they're not focused on, you know, the they're not micro-lasered into their one movement and they're broader, you know, we're able to do better work. I don't know. That's my opinion on it. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that everything is totally interconnected. I tend to think that it's critical that people approach every problem with a systems thinking mindset and being aware of how their piece impacts the broader picture. But I also think that if you constantly are seeing things from a very far distance, it's hard to take really effective action because approaching something from such a general place makes it hard to act specifically. So I think it's imperative to hold both of those things in our heads and hearts at the same time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Well, thank you for calling, Samantha. And if anybody else wants to call in, you've only got 20 minutes left. Well, let's make that 15 minutes. No calls in the last 5 minutes, please. 503-231-8187 to join the conversation with Lindsay Graizel, Daya Schlossberg, and Ken Ward. And the occasion is this fundraiser event tomorrow evening at the Hollywood Theater as part of the Eco Film Festival. That is a showing of part of this new film, The Reluctant Radical, filming the fossil fuel resistance, and Daya Schlossberg's older film, Backyard, and a panel discussion and this about the essential protection the First Amendment provides documentary filmmakers. And that's co-presented by 350PDX. So...
And KABU.
Woohoo.
Here we are.
I'm really excited to be here, by the way, because this is my hometown, you know, community radio show. And
I thought you lived out in Corbett.
Yeah, well, close enough. Drive time if I have to come into the city. But so I just wanted to say I'm really pleased to be here.
Oh, you had to drive through rush hour.
I had to get 84. Up early and come here.
Well,
because I like this place so much.
True. My monthly co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, she said she takes an hour and a half getting in from like Hillsborough. That's a horrible thought. Anyway, but speaking of fossil fuels. So, so you got this film, The Reluctant Radical. I'll just open it up. What else do you want to talk about here this morning?
Well, I think it's interesting, you know, the last caller seemed to talk a bit about personal responsibility in terms of, and that's kind of where I was coming from when I met Ken in terms of like, oh, we have an electric car and we try not to fly too much. And the conversation with Ken made me realize like how woefully inadequate that mindset is and how we all really need to get into a much more of a crisis mode because that's what we're facing. And so I think Ken's approach of civil disobedience in order to move the needle on the political spectrum is, I'd like to sort of move the conversation in that direction because that's what he's doing and it's doing it effectively.
So obviously, you know, it helps to have people, as I said, amplify the actions. You know, when we first started, climbing trees and stuff is there wasn't any... you know, there was no internet, there was no, and we had no idea, like, I guess that's the thing that, you know, it's hard to get across to people who haven't, like, crossed that bridge to, like, doing direct action. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, you know, well, how do I know it's going to do any good or whatever? It's like, but we had no idea and we just did it. And all of a sudden, you know, there's, you know, news helicopters flying overhead and on the front page of the Oregonian and then, you know, international and all that. And it was quite heady at the time. And, you know, now the, obviously the, something similar happened with the Fennica here in Portland, and the Greenpeace climbers had had a lot to do with that, and the all the kayakers, you know, and then the action, the Shell No Action in Seattle. There has been sort of a resurgence of direct action around climate action, climate change here in the Pacific Northwest, certainly. So I guess the thing is, how do you take it? You know, we. Like it was kind of organic back in the day, you know, like when I was involved in Earth First, and it just sort of, it just snowballed. We didn't even like, we had no control over it. But, you know, the idea was just to keep doing more things and then, you know, just keep taking it to the next level. So I don't know, you got any ideas? Obviously your action shutting down the valve to the pipes, that was taking it to another level. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think there's many, I have many thoughts on that, but here's one, which is what we're going to be talking about tomorrow night, which is that we're in a very different environment in terms of communication now than when you were doing and when the tree sits happened and when Earth First was happening. We don't have a national or even an international media. We have this incredibly fragmented ways that people communicate, and including now the web. And one of the things that happened in this action was that we saw the effort to shut down the people who were communicating what we were doing. It was across all of the, when it's happened in four places, and in all four places we had this police response to the people who were documenting, both the people who were live streaming, which was our supporters, and the folks, and Dan and Lindsay and others. So I think that is, in fact, an effort in the absence of national media to make it more difficult for people to communicate what we're actually doing. Because if you can shut down the communication levels, then in fact, we would have done it anyway. Because we're there for our own purposes as well as, feel compelled to take the action. But if people like us are compelled to take the action and then nobody knows about it, it has obviously much less political impact. And I think that's the situation that we're in, where we're seeing laws are proposed and specific police responses and things, especially at Standing Rock, in addition to our experience here.
Your action at least partly in solidarity with what was
totally
going on.
We did it in response to a call from Standing Rock for a day of action and prayer. And we did it for climate, but we did it in response to that call.
So this issue of, were you all surprised did you expect to get arrested?
I certainly did not expect to get arrested. I had taken steps and plans. I knew that I was not going to cross the fence where the, you know, would have been obviously trespassing, and that was a hard decision as a filmmaker because it meant I was really far away from where the action was through a chain link fence. But it was important to me to maintain that boundary. So I was surprised. I knew it was within the realm of possibility, but when I had done a risk calculation, I thought it was pretty low possibility and it was a risk I was worth taking. I was more surprised at the felony charges. I thought maybe they would try trespassing, but to get slapped with three felonies was a shock for sure.
Were your supporters and your lawyers able to sort of convince you that that wasn't likely to stick, or did you all have a feeling that they might actually try to make those charges stick at the time? Because a lot of times they'll stick you with a really bad charge to kind of scare you, and then they'll
It certainly seemed like it was the whole point of it was intimidation. I had the charges for a month, and actually the way they were dismissed too, there's still a possibility that they could, right, you know, technically reopen them. No one really expects them to do that, but we had a planned hearing to go in and say that this was a vengeful prosecution and that the whole thing should be tossed out legally with prejudice. That means that the case is closed, and instead the prosecutor dropped it before we were able to make our arguments to the judge without prejudice, so that they're sort of dangling this threat over my head for the next 3 years. So, but, you know, even though they dropped the charges, it was a month of dealing with, oh, I'm facing three felonies. I need to find a lawyer. I need to travel up to Seattle and work. My footage is confiscated. I couldn't even talk to Ken for the first, what was it, week or 10 days. There was a court order not to speak to the subject of my film. So it definitely had a huge impact on my work.
And again, 503-231-8187. That's the number. You just heard Lindsay Graizel, who's a local documentary filmmaker. So what other films have you made?
Prior to this, I've been primarily working freelance, creating films for nonprofit organizations and museums. So this is my first venture into independent documentary, and I'm enjoying having the freedom to pursue what I really want, the story I really want to tell.
Right on. So yeah, this whole issue of crackdown on, you know, both environmental activism and, you know, depicting environmental crimes, not, you know, what they call, what the authorities like to call eco-terrorism, which is really just attempting to stop eco-terrorism, but, you know, like the ag gag laws, preventing people from filming inside factory farms and that kind of, you know, it's been, you know, 20 years developing, you know, a lot of it started, you know, really back in the Earth First days when they first called environmentalists eco-terrorists. And it seems to be just getting worse and worse, and obviously the current political climate. Is there support amongst, you know, is there like a documentary, like a activist documentary filmmaker kind of community? I mean, is there discussions about this kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a very lonely place being in jail and not realizing the outcry that was happening surrounding our arrests. I think, First Amendment issues are a huge trigger. And the kind of funny circular aspect of this is that media and people in the media, I think we're pretty eager to report on the media being targeted. So our story spread pretty quickly once it did get out there. And this was also right after Amy Goodman had been arrested at Standing Rock.
Let me just interrupt you. I was going to say, you know, I wrote to like NPR, like their national and like their local here. It just peed me off. They never mentioned that. It took them, I don't know, maybe it was like when it finally got dropped or something, they finally mentioned it. But that just really disturbed me.
Well, a lot of the arrests that were happening, a lot of the stories that were being squashed, you know, were related to fossil fuels and fossil fuel infrastructure. And you look at the funding of a lot of these companies and organizations, and you know, there's a conflict of interest there, reporting on stories that criticize their funding. So,
National Petroleum Radio, that's what we say. Anyway, so I realize I've been encouraging people to call in now rather than later, and Sean has been patiently waiting. So, Sean, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. About 7 years ago, Derek Jensen appeared on some obscure radio call-in show, and I was so proud of myself that I managed to like figure out the time difference and everything and actually call in. And the question I asked him was related to family life. And there's this notion of like family gatherings and get-togethers, whether it's reunions or whatever. And you're sitting at the table with, your mother and your father and your siblings. And the question I put to Derek Jensen was, you know, what about all of this social pressure to be a quote-unquote good provider? Like, it seems like, you know, as environmentalists, you know, we want to encourage people to abandon consumerism and walk away from capitalism. But there's this very intense interpersonal pressure, especially within families, to be a, quote, good provider or to be, quote, productive. I know that kind of gets to the psychological aspect of things. I know Bruce Levine is a psychologist, and he's talked about this notion of like personal secession from if the system is evil, then by shutting down you're not taking part in an evil system. So just get to these notions of productivity and being a good provider and that sort of thing. And if you have any thoughts, I'd appreciate it. Thanks,
Ken. That seems to be
I was waiting to see if you could tell me, Sean, what Derek had to say to that. But I can. It's a very good question, and it's definitely it's a major roadblock to action, right? I mean, especially if I'm a dad, in doing this, I walked away from gainful employment in the usual sense, so I'm dead broke. Anticipating jail while I have a kid still in high school. These are really big roadblocks to action. Not everyone is going to be able to do this. I felt like, on balance, that I was doing the right thing for my son. That was a major factor here. I don't really have an answer in that yet. Yeah, it's good to acknowledge that to take effective action at this point, given that there are so many barriers, and those barriers get stronger as they get challenged. That's what we know about cognitive dissonance, right? The purpose of it is to protect you from thinking uncomfortable things. If you have somebody in your family, and I don't go around proselytizing anybody. I never ask anybody to do anything, certainly not within my family. But the mere fact that I am doing these things and other people are doing these things causes pain in others who kind of know at some level they should be doing it. So I'm glad for raising it. There's no easy answer.
All right. Thank you for calling. Let's go straight to Samantha. Is that the you called earlier?
Yes, I did. First, I just want to thank Derek for his comment. Also, island people, we're stuck in the system as long as we're separated or in very small groups. I'd like to do a little book shout out. If you can, Bolo Bolo, it's the 30th anniversary edition, just came out. It's just kind of a philosophical mind study of intentional communities based on everybody kind of working together. It's a great book. It's a great read. Very philosophical. If you can get through the philosophical part, great read. Number two, the reason I called back is about the direct action. If you study direct action, you notice that it's a very patriarchal, warlike concept. Where once again, sorry about the bus just go by. We take an issue and we separate people into one side of the war and the other side of the war. And then we have fence liners who sit up on the fence. And if we're overly aggressive, we're likely to lose those people on the fence due to warlike things. I don't know. I find that direct action is better served in building community versus building like these very war-minded movements. I do understand why a lot of people enjoy them. They get out a lot of frustration. They get to, do all these active things.
Well, Samantha, we only have like 3 minutes left, so let's let people respond to that. And
absolutely.
Okay, thank you so much for calling back. Thoughts?
Well, I obviously totally disagree with you. I think this is the very opposite of warlike, nonviolent direct action.
I think, Ken, you say it well, in putting it in terms of points of moral conflict. It's not actual physical conflict, it's moral conflict. It's point that really it forces people to question their absolute fundamental beliefs. And that's, I fail to see violence in that. I think that's what everybody needs to be doing.
And it brings clarity to the situation. All of the direct actions that Ken has participated, that's exactly what they're doing, is they're setting up a scene where you are forced to not think about all the grays. You're forced to think about the fundamental issue underlying the tension and to face it and recognize it and decide where you stand on the issue.
Oh, no, my response is Leonard Cohen's song, Come On Back to the War. I mean, it's like, we're in a, I mean, like it or not, we're in a war. And the ability to actually, respond without resorting to, guns and armaments is a testament to people's, patience and I don't know, moral integrity. I mean, I'm not personally not a pacifist myself, but that's another long conversation. I think we had one more caller. Really quick, we only have 2 minutes left. Go ahead and make a final quick point here.
Yeah, I understand, Paul, your dismissal of NPR, National Petroleum Radio. What I'm more confused about are the institutions that exist that actually can provide livings and seem to be thriving economically that are on the side of advocacy, but they're so mainstream that they remain irrelevant to the activist community. And when I think about, say, the Sierra Club, one of their editors is a guy named Paul Rauber, who, when I lived in the East Bay in Berkeley, was one of the sharpest alternative journalists. He had a venue in the East Bay Express, and he really drove the activist community to be hard-nosed. And, you know, he's sort of been in retirement for 20 years working at the Sierra Club, which is totally irrelevant.
Okay,
and
Mitch,
talk
we got
about how those institutions collapse.
We got to wrap up. We only have a minute left, so thank you for making that point. Reinforces a point we've been making. We got to get out of here. No time to give all your great last thoughts, but you'll be able to see you all again. That's
tomorrow night at the Hollywood Theater, 7:30. We'll have select scenes from the film as well as Backyard and a panel discussion with Ken and ourselves and my lawyer, actually.
And we can continue a lot of these discussions further there.
In person. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Wednesday Talk Radio. See you next week.